Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSHD Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSHD Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of people affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSHD Society Radio. Welcome one and all to the FSHD Society Radio Show. I am here on, July 29th as we bring you a live show via Facebook, and we're also using Zoom because we have a big show in store for you today. In front of you is a lot of faces as our guests are already locked and loaded into the Zoom room, I guess. Maybe we can call it that, as we have a great conversation in store for you today about the Americans with Disabilities Act 30-year anniversary. If you want to, you know, even search that hashtag ADA30. That's what we're going to talk about today. But first, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can do that via email. fshdradio@fshdsociety.org is a great way to do that. You can also chime in on Facebook, as I am able to still see your comments on there. So please feel free to do that. And love to hear what you have to say about this subject. Like I said, we have a lot of guests that are going to be in, kind of chiming in a little bit with us, kind of a roundtable discussion. Real quick, though, before we get going with this show, stay tuned. Don't forget, next week, we have another great episode in store for you as we're going to welcome in the South Carolina chapter director, Frank Hanley. He's going to talk about his Che Gong and Kung Fu. He's a teacher in that regard, as well as being a chapter director, and he's going to talk to us about how that helps him fight FSHD. So that's in store for next week's show, August 5th. So now let's start unmuting and start having some fun here. See if we can have the power to do that. One after the other, slow but sure, as we all trying to welcome in everyone except Howard. We're having a hard time with getting his unmute going there. So we're going to welcome him. Let's get who we can get a voice into, and that's Cardin Wyckoff is here, Daniel Liptek, and Melissa Reyes. Am I pronouncing that right, Melissa?
It's Reese.
Reese. Like, my apologies. Oh, my goodness. And Howard is also now live and available to speak as well. So welcome all. Thanks for being here to the show. Never had four Thank guests you. On before, so we're going to have a lot of fun voices chiming in as we discuss ADA 30, as I'm just going to abbreviate it that way for us. Makes my life easier. So let's go kind of around the room, so to speak. Why don't we start with Danny? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your FSHD story, maybe, or just kind of give us a little background who you are.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me. I was born and adopted from Santiago, Chile, and we moved to the United States when I was about 2 or 3 years old. I spent most of my adult life in Virginia school. I went to a university in Virginia as well. Then I got a job after college working with children and adults with autism. That's when my FSHD started to progress pretty rapidly. I went from not needing any assistive devices to quickly needing a brace, a cane, a walker, and then a manual wheelchair. So a lot of my future plans kind of changed in that sense. I went from wanting to be really involved working with children my cat might pop up just like whenever I start talking, she just seems to want to come over. But yeah, so I kind of changed my career path and I went to a paralegal program. So I have a degree in clinical psychology and I have another degree in paralegal studies. And now I'm getting my master's in strategic communication. So I'm pretty much set for whatever comes my way, job-wise or future-wise.
Yeah.
But Yeah, it's been a really interesting like road since getting diagnosed at 12 and now, yes, we can't, yeah. now being 31 and still changing.
Absolutely. Yeah. How about
that's a quick and dirty.
That's a quick and How about you, Melissa? We'll have you up next. Tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a staff attorney at Disability Rights Advocates. We're an organization that's been around almost as long as the ADA. This year will be our 27th year, I believe. And we have offices in New York, Berkeley, California, and Chicago. And we do a wide variety of mostly impact litigation, so class actions, trying to achieve systemic changes and address systemic discrimination against people with all different kinds of disabilities.
Awesome. And so you have a lot to bring to the table here when we come to talk about this topic today, it sounds like. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Howard, why don't we put you on?
Yes, I'm 62. I'm a retired lawyer. I live in San Francisco. I'm on the board of the FSHD Society. I'm a retired corporate lawyer. I've lived in San Francisco since 82, and I'm involved in disability access advocacy. I was, for about 5 years, I was chair of the San Francisco Mayor's Disability Council's Physical Access Committee, where we gave input to the city on various projects. I've also been involved in some other city committees relating to access. And I've been a plaintiff in about five or six ADA lawsuits. And I've also kind of informally advised some restaurants and some hotels. And also I've written articles on wheelchair accessible travel in Europe and Israel.
Awesome. Wow. That's quite the resume there, Howard. Thank you for being here. I guess now you're up, Carden. I think we all know who you are, but you know, I don't want to leave you out, right?
Yeah, sure. Hey everyone, it's great to be back. And my name is Carden Wyckoff. I'm an Atlanta native. Currently live here as well. I work in tech and I'm also on the board of directors with Howard. I was diagnosed with FSHD when I was 8 years old, showed symptoms about 4. And so I've just been an advocate for disabilities my whole life, essentially. And so that's what I do every day, just to make the world a better place for everyone, more inclusive and equitable for sure. So I'm thankful to be here.
And that's kind of, yeah, why we are here, right? We're trying to talk about the Disabilities Act hitting its 30th anniversary. And I'm going to kind of, you know, I'll throw out some questions here and there, but I think where I want to start is maybe, you know, pre-ADA times, maybe this is more for Howard, you know, is there a story you can share about, you know, before ADA and before all that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, Tim. I started using a wheelchair coincidentally in 1990, the year that the ADA was passed. And even in San Francisco, which is a pretty liberal, you might say, city, at that time, the buses were not wheelchair accessible. There were the curb ramps, were what people often call curb cuts. There were not nearly enough of them. There were many, many, many corners that didn't have them. And those that did, the design was pretty poor. It was quite steep and so forth. Even most restaurants, or at least many restaurants, did not have wheelchair accessible bathrooms. It was difficult to find a truly wheelchair accessible room with a roll-in shower in hotels in Chicago, New York, other cities. So I've seen a lot of progress. Of course, there's a lot that remains, and you know, maybe Melissa will probably talk, you know, more about that. But I've I mentioned that I was plaintiff in a number of lawsuits, and maybe I'll tell you about one or two of them.
Yeah, please.
Several of them, DRA, Disability Rights Advocates, where Melissa works, represented me. Most of these are physical access lawsuits. One of them was against a building, an office building of about 8 or 10 stories in downtown San Francisco. Basically, they had a stoop and no level access into the building. I had been interested in a job in a law firm that worked in that building, that was located in that building. Even though I didn't get the offer or even an interview, in anticipation, I went by and I saw that that building was completely inaccessible. So I wrote to the manager of the building, and I got back a letter from the building's lawyer saying, you know, sorry about that. If you ever need to get into this building, just get the attention of the security guard in the front desk, and he'd be happy to lift up your wheelchair up that, you know, 10-inch stoop. Well, I don't think he was trying to blow me off. I think it was sincere ignorance, both in terms of that's not cool to have to do that, but second of all, my wheelchair is 300 pounds, and I don't want to say how much I weigh. So there's just no way that, you know, that you could get into a building. So I ended up, you know, having to sue them. Again, that was with DRA representing me. And, you know, we got a settlement where they converted the stoop into a, you know, a sloped ramp. So that's an example of how much ignorance, you would say, there was. I don't think it was really mean-spiritedness or anything like that, but just basic ignorance.
Right.
Maybe one other that I would talk about is Wrigley Field. I'm a Chicago native, and back in the 1990s, I was back visiting my family with my wife, Michelle, and I had been a vendor at Wrigley Field when I was in high school. And about 3 weeks in advance of the game, this was before you could get tickets online, I called and tried to get tickets and was told that all of the wheelchair accessible seating was already sold out about 3 weeks before the game. And then when I was in Chicago during that time, I looked at the newspaper and there were about 10,000 unsold seats on the day of that game. So basically what that means is that there's clearly not enough wheelchair accessible seating if there's all the wheelchair accessible seats are sold out 3 weeks in advance of the game, mm-hmm. yet on game day there's 10,000 empty seats. Mm. I was one of several plaintiffs in that lawsuit, and it was not a class action, so anybody else could also sue later on, and we got a pretty good settlement where the Cubs put in an elevator. They upgraded the bathroom access. They increased the number of wheelchair accessible seats. But I read last year, and I just checked it now today, that the Department of Justice is investigating the Cubs because they basically did about a $1 billion renovation over the past few years, and there's significant disability access problems still. Wow. And in fact, there is an ongoing lawsuit, at least it was ongoing as of December last year. I couldn't find anything more about it. There's an ongoing lawsuit by a young man with muscular dystrophy, and his father happens to be an attorney. And their allegation is that the $1 billion renovation actually made disability access worse. So that's kind of a tale of progress and then, you know, maybe sort of two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue then for Melissa talking about, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Then what does that mean then with the law today here? Melissa, can you comment on on any upcoming landmark cases, maybe some of what, you know, Howard is kind of talking about and build off of that.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that that has also been our experience in terms of, I think a good example of that is the transportation area, where there was a lot of advocacy in the 90s and early 2000s to get wheelchair accessible taxi service in a number of different cities, and it was very hard fought because the taxi industry is so fragmented and subject to local and state regulation. Certainly in the Bay Area and San Francisco specifically, there was some success in finally getting some support and, getting the taxi companies to start providing increasing their fleet of wheelchair accessible vehicles. Around the time that the rideshare companies started becoming more and more successful and really negatively affecting the taxi industry. And so now we are in this situation where we are addressing how the extent to which the Americans with Disabilities Act covers new industries like the rideshare industry, which didn't exist when the ADA was passed in 1990,
right.
And how it includes or covers entities providing services through new technologies. So I think that is something, the way that the ADA can adapt and be and evolve to continue to provide protections even as the many different types of public accommodations and transactions and ways that people interact also develop because of technology and other societal developments.
Yeah, so it sounds like this is an always evolving issue where, like you said, we didn't have the rideshare thing at 1990. Now we're trying to, it almost feels like it's like a catch-up mode all the time where life is moving so quickly. And the ADA just doesn't adapt fast enough. Am I speaking correctly in that regard in observation?
Well, I think to some extent, it was written 30 years ago and things looked right. Very different 30 years ago, but there's a lot of great tools in the ADA and a lot of great flexibility in there as well to kind of adapt to changing times. And so, certainly, our position is that the ADA is a flexible law, and it is it's very clear about the goal being to provide them the maximum to prioritize accommodations for people, and we have been advancing that argument in lots of different contexts about how it should be and how it should do so, for sure.
Without the disability rights advocates that you work with, Melissa, who would be monitoring this to make sure things are evolving as time moves forward with the ADA?
I mean, that's a great point that you make, Tim. I mean, this is one of the amazing accomplishments of the ADA is that it placed a lot of power in the hands of individuals who are experiencing discrimination themselves to take action. And, there's not an accessibility police force out there making sure that people are complying to a large extent. And so the tools that the law provides to individuals, members of the public, is really pretty unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And I understand that it is sort of a model for other, internationally in terms of putting that power in people's hands.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like it has to be a community standing up and making sure that, hey, this is wrong. We have to make it right. And then going even through what Howard was going through. Okay. Then we have a lawsuit. We make sure we have a claim so that there's change. We're kind of our own police. Cardin and Danny, I guess I can throw this next one at you guys. Being the next generation, right, of advocates, What are your perspectives on disability rights?
I'll go first.
Okay.
I mean, 30 years is it's my whole life.
Yeah.
It's a long time to have a law and have so many people not know about it and not take the time to educate themselves. Like, I agree with what Melissa said. It puts a lot of it in our hands, but people only take you so seriously unless someone else supports you. So, like, take the Black Lives Matter movement right now, actually, for so long. Things are only getting done when other people speak up about the systemic problems in this country and in the world. And it's like, we need almost an ADA police. It's not enough that I have to educate myself so much about these laws that I have to take the time. Like, I don't have a degree in law. Like, I can only say something to someone, like an example, the grandfathered clause or the safe harbor clause. Mm. Whenever there's a new business in the city that I live in and I try to discuss accessibility with them, that's like the first thing they try to use. That's the first excuse they try to use. And it's not even a real thing. There is no grandfathered clause. They try to say it's historic. And I'm like, okay, you're putting a building above people. You can't really call yourself a public, like open to the public, if you're excluding me. So
Right. It's
tiring having to be such an advocate, but like, I'm not gonna stop. But I just hope that it's not just my voice and it's not just Cardin's voice. And I appreciate Melissa and I appreciate Howard, like getting into law and like having law involved in lawsuits and like speaking up for us. But we need people who aren't disabled, people without FSHD, to actually step up and do stuff for the ADA, or else it's just going to be another 30 years and we're going to be having this same discussion.
Yeah, Danny, you make an incredible point, multiple great points, one with the policing force. And while there is a lot of power in having individuals carry the issues forward and to speak up and to advocate for that change, at the same time, it is so exhausting to continue to have to go to a new place, to a new thing, and always have to like check, is this accessible? Is the bathroom accessible? Am I going to be discriminated against? Will I have stairs to go inside? Can I have a friend sit next to me? Is there seating there for a companion? What about if you are a special needs child but you're an adult child? Maybe you're 21 and you have special needs. How do you go to the bathroom and there's no adult changing station? I mean, there's just so many issues that we continue to face. And I personally feel like we should have almost an enforcing body at the state level in each state. So I think there is a lot of power right now with technology and social media, all of these movements. It's almost like we're in a civil rights 2.0, maybe even a 3.0, where the social media has really helped to elevate and bring awareness to these issues, not only racial injustices, but for other minority groups as well, especially if you see it with the LGBTQ movement and how much progress that they have made for equal representation there. So it's coming for people with disabilities, and obviously champion and thank the people that came before me. I'm 27. I was born after the ADA. And yet to this day, I still face issues, things like transit and the built environment. What about funding for special education in grade school and teaching and having teachers giving them training on how to equip students? Education is the key to independence. Bias training. I think everyone in this world should have a bias training on the different minority groups and to really understand that, to elevate them and to understand. And now with this digital age, we have faced so many issues with digital accessibility. There's websites all over the place that don't prioritize accessibility and they're going against the law. Then we have workplace discrimination and hiring discrimination. Though we do have those protections in there, people still won't hire people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Our unemployment rate is double what the standard unemployment rate is. And then thinking about other social issues, like what about disability equal pay and going to an event, like a corporate event. I work in corporate and I go to these trade shows during non-COVID, right? And all of the booths are standing level. They're all at, you know, standing height, eye level. What about me, right? So I think it does take the power of the allies, and especially in tech, I think just in that culture that I have lived in and worked in as well, is so many people now are aware of these issues in the tech industry and they do care about them. There are so many other industries that don't know about it. I spoke at a bank today and none of them really knew about disability awareness and advocacy, and someone didn't even know what the ADA was. So that's a little scary to me to know that they don't know that the protection's in place. And then the final thing what I see now with where the ADA is going and just this whole social change is using inclusive language so that we are not penalizing people with disabilities and that they are seen, heard, and valued. So that people first language. So instead of saying a wheelchair bound, where the wheelchair is almost like a bad object, right? That's putting it as, you know, just something that no one wants to be around, mm-hmm. versus someone who uses a wheelchair. A little bit more positive, and it's more like an extension to your body. Mm-hmm. So a person who is deaf, a person who is blind or hard of hearing, not a person, not, you know, someone where the disability is the central focus. Mm. We have a lot to do.
Yeah, man. There's, yeah, you.
And the list is endless, right?
The list is endless. I feel
sure
absolutely.
Melissa can definitely speak to that. Yeah.
Go ahead, Howard.
I think sometimes there can be a little too much rigidity in language, or a little bit too much maybe political correctness. I was in a meeting years ago where someone introduced herself by saying, I am her name, and I am a person who is blind. I mean, she could have just said, I am, you know, Jane Doe, and I'm blind. So there's a little bit, I think, sometimes too much rigidity that everybody has to sort of speak the same language exactly. It's really just a question of, you know, respectfulness and being aware of how a person wants to be referred to. So I think it's, you know, I think it can go a little too far sometimes. That was an example.
Yeah.
I think you need it to go a little too far because there's always going to be someone who takes it too far. So you need these rules. You need people to stand up and say, like, I am a person who's blind and I want you to refer to me that way. Like, I get that we want everyone to be comfortable and we want everyone to feel like it's okay to talk freely and stuff. But when you allow people to not, like, use their best judgment when talking about someone, it can get taken too far really quickly. So it's like, we need these rules. We need the politically correct people to stand up for those that aren't there. That's just my opinion. Like, I never get upset with someone who corrects me if my language is not appropriate to, like, what they think. If I have offended them in a way, like, I met a person who was colorblind and I said something along the lines of, how do you tell what the traffic lights are? I mean, how ignorant of me, even a person with a disability. And I got corrected and I appreciated it. I don't take offense to being corrected. And I think that's a really big problem that a lot of people who are able-bodied have. When I correct them, like, if someone I'm out at a bar and someone asks me, what's wrong with you? I don't know. What's wrong with you?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think it's appropriate for you to ask me about my medical condition while I'm taking a shot of tequila.
Right.
There's a time and a place. Yeah.
So you believe then maybe that a correction equals education.
Yeah, as Carden said, education is the key to independence.
Yeah.
And language, as we've learned, whether you're Black, part of the LGBTQ community, the disabled community, there are words that shouldn't be spoken. And if you let even the littlest amount go, someone will take it too far. I mean, not to get political, but like, we have a president who made fun of someone with a disability, like a reporter.
Right. And that's a fact. Yeah.
Yeah. Still got voted in. And I feel like that's such a step back for people with disabilities, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Obviously, completely out of place, out of line.
I think the interesting thing about this language also is that it's not just about following rules, but it can help people stop and think about the assumptions that they're making that they aren't even aware of, that comes out through the language that they use. And so, you know, something as simple as somebody saying that they are a person who is blind rather than that they are blind, you know, they don't define themselves solely by the fact that they're blind, maybe. And, you know, just kind of considering those assumptions is really important, and an important conversation that I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about, you know, working with the ADA as a law is that there's places where it's 2020 and there's new issues coming up and we're able to apply the law in a new and interesting way. And there are other places where it feels like, you know, it could be 30 years ago because there's been no change. And I think that there's the same is true in terms of the dialogue about disability, that it's really different depending on where you go. And so I really agree with Danny and Carden, what you've been saying about education and the importance of kind of uplifting the conversation and making more people a part of it, and helping them have tools to have, you know, be able to think about and talk about disability in a constructive way.
Yeah, I would say that there's kind of like these three models of disability and how we look at that. And this does tie into this language. So there's like a medical model. So we see a disabled person or someone with I just said it incorrectly myself. So person who has a disability, who has an impairment or a health condition, and that's the problem. So they focus on the limitation and not the actual person. So that's generally not such a good thing. And then you have this so-called tragedy model where we see people with disabilities as deserving pity and like, oh, woe is you. Like, I feel sorry for you. So let me try and help you. Kind of like a charity case. Mm-hmm. And what we're shifting towards is now this social model where we're building this base of allies and also advocates for people with disabilities, where they help to remove barriers from the environment. And that environment could be digital, built, you know, whatever the environment that is in. And so they advocate for removing those barriers to help that individual that has those inequities.
Touch on Howard's story about the Cubs stadium.
Please.
Last year, December last year, I went to a Washington Capitals hockey game with a bachelorette party. We had 6 months prior, we set everything up, like literally 6 months. We were in communication. We had the seating. We had the section. We bought a group pass. We get there and there are people where I'm supposed to sit. So we go to the front desk area and we tell them, and they end up taking me to the top of the stadium, to the very last row. Like, I was up against the concrete along with two other people in wheelchairs. And I was completely baffled as to what to do. And I think that's a thing, like, I don't know, do I call, again, there's no ADA police,
right,
but I knew that this was wrong. And the people that I was with, the bride and and our the bridesmaids, they knew it was wrong. And it turned out that the stadium had given those seats, those accessible seats, to season ticket holders. And I mean, we wrote three letters to Ted Leonis, the owner of the Capitals, and we had them like specially mailed to his house and to the stadium and where he works in his office. And we haven't heard anything. And I personally don't know the steps to take when it comes to like doing something like you did, Howard. And in that sense, I feel a little lost, and I'm right. sure a lot of people are discriminated against in that sense, you know, going to concerts, sporting events, graduations, weddings, whatever. And I paid for like 6 months ahead thinking that I was going to be in this accessible seating. And it's just like, it's strange as to what to do next. I usually go to social media and I'll have a lot of friends share it. And someone will say like, message me, and you message them, but nothing ever really changes. Hmm. So like, where do you go from there?
Yeah, what's
how
the
do
next
you
step?
The
well, that's, you know, that's awful. That should just not be happening. Yeah. And if they have not responded in any way, then it's time to talk to a lawyer. I mean, you know, I'll put in a little plug for DRA. Every state, and Melissa can jump in, because you know it better than I do, but in every state there's a protection and advocacy organization, which basically is a government-funded public interest law firm. And so you contact them or private nonprofits such as DRA, if there is one in your area, and you know, meet with them, talk to them, you know, and they'll give you advice as to what can be done. A situation like that, where it's a stadium of a professional sports team, they will most likely have heard some complaints from other people as well. And, you know, when you join together, you know, there's a lot more power than one individual person. But I think given what happened and given that they have not responded to you in any way, I'd urge you to contact either your local protection and advocacy organization, or if there is a specific disability rights law firm, contact them.
And Danny, I would welcome you to reach out to us.
Okay, like thank you.
Talk about it
wow.
further.
Melissa, we had a question that was on the Facebook page asking, how did you get into the field of disability rights?
Well, I started out doing more sort of just consumer protection work in general. And then I learned about disability rights advocates. I'm a Bay Area native, and just about all of the just the hundreds of cases that they had brought trying to just change the built environment in the Bay Area. And I wanted to join them in that work. And so I was able to join them as a staff attorney. And I think, you know, as you have all been pointing out, you know, there is a huge onus that's placed on individuals to advocate for themselves. And so being able to use legal tools to kind of, you know, support those efforts is really, I feel very grateful to be able to do that.
Another question, and, you know, anyone that knows this answer, just, you know, jump in, that was on the Facebook page here. Are there any major cases or legislation coming up that people should be aware of?
I mean, I can just speak to, I don't want to focus just on what, you know, on my own work, because there's just so many angles many ways in which the ADA and anti disability discrimination law is applied, but maybe just to kind of highlight some of the things that we've been up to in transportation. We've been working on trying to improve the accessibility of the New York subway, and I alluded to this earlier, but doing a lot of litigation involving the rideshare companies Uber and Lyft in a number of different areas or regions around the country. But we, you know, our work is a lot broader, and we do, for example, with the kind of just the explosion in the number of people who are held in immigration detention, we have become involved in a lawsuit to work on the conditions under which people are held there. So, you know, that includes the way that people with disabilities are accommodated and treated in immigration detention, as well as in various other institutions, prisons and jails and juvenile facilities in various parts of the country. So that's a kind of a huge area.
It is huge.
Also, we've done, we started doing some work on, these are just to kind of name a few issues, mental health, particularly in education and higher education specifically.
Those are all amazing.
Yeah.
Awesome. I will say, in general, states do have the power to add on and create their own you know, legislation to continue to move the needle forward. So I know, for example, San Francisco has an accessible entrance program. Then same thing with Texas, also created that. So I know at the individual state level, they do, and this is again, state by state, new legislations are being passed to give additional benefits and protections for people with disabilities to break down those barriers. So am I aware of like an ADA redo, like a, you know, a 2020 ADA push out? I've not heard anything about that. I think the ADA is an incredible law. It was very well written. It's bipartisan as well, which is incredible. That regardless of politics, they came together and created this framework to help people with disabilities. But I'm sure there are things that probably could be added to the ADA, and maybe in the future we could see, you know, a 2030 version. Who knows?
Well, there's been regulations. I mean, the basic statute hasn't changed that much, but over the decades, there have been various iterations of regulations which take into account both new issues that hadn't been thought of, or that improve elements that have already been there. So when gaps are found, let's say, but that's a very complex and multi-year process. So it's not as if there's an annual or biennial, you know, update. It's there have been a handful of them in 30 years. Also, to the point, to your point, Carden, about state and local laws kind of adding to the protections of the ADA, San Francisco and I think Seattle and Portland and probably several other cities passed laws a while ago that when a bar or a restaurant or a hotel lobby, let's say, or a hospital, when there's a television on, they have to have open captioning so that if a deaf person walks in and they don't have to specifically ask for the captioning to be turned on, the captioning is always on by default, which is, you know, an example of something that really wasn't thought of to that level of detail, you know, under ADA regulations, but local, various local ordinances have been passed to take care of that.
And that brings up another point for me, Howard, just a thought just popped into my head, is the ADA doesn't just benefit people with disabilities. It benefits all. And pretty much everyone in the world probably, or I guess let's form it to the United States, has benefited from the ADA. Have you ever ridden an elevator? Have you ever you know, hide your luggage and taking it off a curb cut ramp. Hide your bicycle. Exactly. I mean, there's so many. Have you ever, are you carrying a bunch of things in your hands and press a push to open button to open up the door automatically? Those are all examples of how the ADA has benefited the world. And it's set the framework for the world. It's what Howard said in the beginning, is the ADA was able to then, you know, give suggestions to other countries. So, and how they show up for people with disabilities.
And so like to really go awesome. Off of what Cardin said, how it affects us all, whether you have a disability or not. That's the thing. I think people who do not have someone disabled in their life are not disabled themselves. It is somehow so far back in their mind, yet if they're so quick to take advantage of things that are specifically for people with disabilities, parking in the handicap space, bringing their dog in with an emotional support vest that they got off Amazon. Like, I can't tell you how many times someone told me that they were just running in and I'm sitting in my van waiting to drop my ramp because they're just parked just horribly in a handicap space they're not even supposed to be in. And somehow we need to bring disability to people's the forefront of their mind and not as just like the brunt of a joke, like when you call someone lame or stupid or say like, I'm being so OCD right now. Those are not things that you should use when talking about someone who's not disabled. And it's like this weird balance. People think of disability in a certain way, but when you actually ask them for help, when you actually need them to like step up for you, it's not at the top of their list. But if it benefits them, then it is. Like this working from home, picking up groceries, curbside pickup at grocery stores, like these are all things that we've used as disabled people. So I think we have to show people who don't have disability on the forefront of their brain that this will benefit them in the future. This will probably be them in the future. So, I mean, that's my little rant.
Well, you're getting into really universal design, which is, you know, as Cardin said, basically, we find out afterwards that curb ramp that we thought was really mostly for people in wheelchairs and for blind people with the yellow textured dome and all that, then we find that people with pushing a baby stroller or the UPS, you know, driver, delivery person, that sort of thing. So as design becomes more and more universal, it benefits everybody in ways that were not expected. I have a kind of a strange counterexample. In Zurich, Switzerland, this was a while ago, maybe 15 years, 10 years, I encountered several buildings, commercial buildings in downtown Zurich, where there were very sophisticated electric doors, sliding doors, but there were two or three stairs to get in. So you'd think it's kind of, they don't really get the electric door opener is sort of thought of for everybody, but they don't go the step further and realize, well, we have three stairs. Maybe we should put in a ramp.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the purpose of the door sliding open if you don't have a ramp? I mean, the doors are just cool now.
Well, because it's the idea is that able-bodied people, that it benefits able-bodied people to have the door, electric door opener. It was just sort of an odd.
It is odd.
Juxtaposition to me.
Now we touched on this earlier. I think Danny did when she had the issue with the Washington Capitals and dealing with their building, and how that situation, how they poorly handled it, obviously. And then it brought up that question of like, well, then what do you do? Like, where do you go? And that's one of the questions in the Facebook page as well, is what resources are there for people to know what their rights are And then I would almost add to that myself and go, and then where do they go to take action? What's their first steps?
Google everything. That's no, like Google's not a lawyer, right, Melissa? But like, that's the first thing. And then I have a document that's like ADA and I bookmark everything. But again, it's just chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will take a stab at that. I always approach it by asking for a manager. Mm. Ideally, if there's not just like a front end manager, but like a general manager or like a store owner or, you know, whatever it is, approach them first, you know, pull them to the side. Take a deep breath before you start that conversation because you're heated, right? You're angry because you have been discriminated against. You don't have access. You've been excluded some way. And it's important to frame the conversation of, this is my experience. And let me just share with you the story that I have. And this is a way that you can be a better servant to guests with disabilities in your environment. And do you have, you know, 5 minutes for me to talk to you about it? And so just laying out the facts, not emotions. I've learned don't get triggered, but just lay it out and then provide a solution. And you will find 9 times out of 10 that owners that generally care about their guests, that come into their doors, they want business, right? Especially during COVID. They will thank you for giving the time to share their experience because you don't know what you don't know. And again, these general managers, they're probably not lawyers. They probably don't know much about the ADA. They maybe have a general contractor that came in, checked a bunch of boxes and said, okay, you're ADA compliant. And the general manager's like, okay, sounds good. I guess this is great. But it does take those experiences by people with disabilities to share their experience. And what I've found going and helping a number of restaurants in the Atlanta area is they will turn around as quickly as possible to make those changes. Mm-hmm. One of my restaurants that I go to often, the door swing of the bathroom was reversed and it was going into the toilet instead of away from the toilet. So I couldn't get into the bathroom. He goes, gets a drill from his like back closet, goes, I'm fixing this right now. And he switched it right then and there. And so it's really great when you just take a deep breath, like I said, and then talk to them about the issue and then what way that you don't need to know all the different inches and heights and things of what it can be. If you want, you can share a document with them, you know, pull up, you can dive in ADA accessible grab bar heights mm-hmm. and 1,000 results are going to pull up on Google. Right. And you can share that universal design article for them. So, but there are courses. I actually took a course on learning about the different titles of the ADA. And that gave me a general understanding of where things were. And I don't know everything because I haven't fully studied it, but it's going to take a long time to know everything in that law. It's huge. So.
And Cardin, as a lawyer, I want to thank you for sharing that insight because I feel like people, you know, there's a lot of times where things get escalated. And that's when I and my organization come in and there's a big conflict and people are really adversarial. And I think that so much can be accomplished from people just having human interactions and trying to solve problems together before we need to kind of, you know, obviously there's a place for bringing your rights in court and, you know, not everyone responds positively to that, but I think a lot of people do. And so thank you for sharing that advice.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I think that your example is spot on. Most people want to do the right thing. And most businesses want to do the right thing. Sometimes it's a question of just not knowing what the right thing is. Sometimes it's money. Sometimes it's just they want to do it, but they're overwhelmed and it sort of stays on the back burner until somebody pulls them aside and says, hey, it's really not that difficult to do the right thing. Sometimes there are people that are recalcitrant, and you know, that's when Melissa comes in. Mm-hmm. Also, I think to Danny's question before, there's a pretty good website by the Justice Department, the U.S. Department of Justice, which is ada.gov. And so that's a good starting point for finding out where you can call, you know, who you can contact, what are the different laws, because it's not only the ADA, there's many, many other disability rights laws. So that's a good starting point. I just went on it today. It's a little bit old fashioned in its look and feel, but there is a lot of good information there.
Yeah, one thing that I also have done is, as Howard said, if a business owner is being recalcitrant, if you have talked to them multiple times, if you have tweeted them and Facebooked them, calling out the issue multiple times and still no resolve, there is something called a mediation claim that you can Google mediation ADA, whatever issue, and a form will pop up, and it is a place for you to express how you have been discriminated against. And the Department of Justice, well, it'll start locally, but it does go into the Department of Justice's network, and someone will reach out to you. Definitely want to write in, please file with mediation. It will speed up the process, but and then just wait 6 months to a year to then be responded back to. But I have gone through mediation multiple times for those restaurant owners that just don't care at all. And it is sad. But at the same time, you gotta keep moving the needle forward.
How about a final thought for anybody, is maybe this question poses out to finish the conversation of your hopes, I guess, in 10 years from now or another 30 years from now, as the ADA evolves and changes, what are your hopes for the future of it?
Yeah, I can go. So I don't really necessarily think we need to like change the law or anything, but mm-hmm. I think it really starts with educating ourselves, and it starts at a very young age. We need to have programs and services and training in grade school where students learn about different minority groups and understand what a person with disability is and how they can be supportive allies for them to stand up for that change, because I am just one individual, again, and all these other people here, we're just one individual that have a disability. But if we have a classroom of advocates and allies, that, you know, quadruples the amount of barriers that we can break down, because that one person can then call out a curb ramp, or that one person can call it, and maybe they don't know all the right things, but starting with grade school. Have training programs.
Like that.
That's where I'd like to see it go. And it's getting there. It's just slow.
For me, I guess like the ultimate, I'm 80 years old, sitting in my whatever, in my futuristic porch. I'd like to look out and see like a world where we're not so surprised to see the lead person in a TV show with a disability as the main character, where disability is celebrated the same way pride is, the same way being Black is. It's not looked at as something that makes you less, but makes you more. Mm. And I would hope that somehow in the future, I mean, when I was first diagnosed, I even thought this way as well. I can't imagine being in a wheelchair, that would be the end for me. Instead, I'd like someone to look at my life and be like, okay, she took that, she accepted it, and was able to do great things despite. Mm-hmm. But you know, you don't forget who you are. I want people, the next generation, to feel as proud as I am being a disabled woman. Mm-hmm.
How about Melissa or Howard? Any any final thought you want to add?
Bringing it a little bit more toward back towards, say, the built environment and also infrastructure and communications and so forth. I mean, I think things are getting better all the time, even though there are these examples to the contrary. But overall, things are improving. And again, two steps forward, maybe one step back. But there's accumulated know-how. There is better attitudes. There's better ways of sharing information and best practices and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's we have to be constantly vigilant. A few years ago, there was a attempt in Congress to weaken the ADA, and it actually passed the House, but it it was stymied in the Senate, thanks largely to Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, who's a double amputee. But even despite that, I'm optimistic. I think, like I said, there's more progress than there is reversal.
Yeah, I'm building on that point, Howard. I think, you know, I imagine a future where, you know, it's not a surprise when people come to a company and say, your website is inaccessible. You could have built it all along from the beginning to be accessible so that everyone could use it. Or, you know, you didn't make the entrance to your building accessible. Instead, these universal design principles are just kind of a matter of course that are just how, you know, how people and businesses do, you know, go about their business and their work. And I think there's been some great victories, and I hope that we continue to see that trend, kind of a more accessible marketplace and world and way that people, you know, think about. Mm-hmm. About disability.
Well said. Well, thanks guys for being here on the show. It was awesome having all four of you here. Danny, Melissa, Howard, Carden, thanks for being here today on the show. Value was amazing. The wisdom, advice, and great stories as I guess we celebrate the 30 years of this. And I don't know, just look forward to more positive change in the future is the way I see it.
Thank you so much.
So that is the forum we have here. And we wanted to make it like a roundtable discussion. We wanted to make it where we get some great voices within this topic and talk about it. And had some great questions that chimed in as well. Before we let you go and closing up shop here for the show for this week, don't forget we have another episode coming up next week, August 5th, as we have the South Carolina chapter director, Frank Hanley, talking about his Qigong and Kung Fu teachings, how he believes that has helped his fight in FSHD. Also, there is more in store in the FSHD Society. If you want to check out fshdsociety.org, you can find a lot of information there, including what's going on with events. For instance, there is the virtual walk and roll September 12th. Don't forget that. I think that is going to be a huge fun event that we are starting to create and build right now, and looking forward to bringing a FSHD radio show that day to you as we go virtual on the walk and roll. And there's webinars coming up throughout the months coming as well. August 20th has a webinar where we're talking about the scapular stabilization surgery with Dr. Anthony Romeo. He is the chief of ortho at Rothman Orthopedics in New York. So he's going to be on that webinar. So many things coming, and we want you to make sure that you're all educated and knowing what's going on. And I appreciate you being here today. If you want to reach out to me after the show, you can do that via email, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. So until next week, we bid you all farewell, and thanks for listening. This has been the FSHD Society Radio Show.